Good evening. I hope you had an excellent afternoon, and glad to see all of you here with us this evening. Go ahead and get your outlines out of the PM side. Again, talking about Ecclesiastes, and so it's prudent for us. It's been 2 weeks, so I will remind you that the book of Ecclesiastes is about earthly wisdom. And as such, we need to be reminded that he is talking about things under the sun. And so, obviously, in a lot of cases, he's going to be speaking about wise decisions and choices. And while we will make a reference at the end about the wisest choice one can make, he's not ultimately leading into spirituality. He is talking primarily, exclusively under the sun. The book of Ecclesiastes, especially this section, reminds me a great deal of the book of Colossians and the book of Hebrews. The book of Hebrews especially, but the book of Colossians is very much about how Christ is superior to everything. But the book of Hebrews breaks it down very succinctly and individual categories, how Christ is better than the old covenant, or the law of Christ is better than the law of Moses, how Christ is a better high priest, how he's a better sacrifice, how he's better at every particular thing that is necessary for human life and spirituality. Christ is better. And that's what the Hebrews writer is talking about. In this circumstance, we're going to be looking at the word better, particularly how wise choices or making wise choices is better than making foolish choices or less wise choices more particularly. And there are, in fact, 8 better than statements, even though the word better than is not found in all of them. Some of them are supplied. We'll see that specifically in verse 1, but we'll begin here in verse 1. And we're only going to deal with half of verse 1 to begin with. He says, a good name is better than precious ointment. And if you stop there a second, a good name is better than precious ointment. This sounds probably pretty familiar if you study through the Proverbs. Solomon makes this same argument in Proverbs 22 and verse 1 where he says a good name is preferable, I'd rather have that, than great riches. But in this case, he's talking about something that smells. He's using a metaphor in context to something smelling. He's saying it is better to have a good smelling reputation than to smell good physically. And so he would desire such a thing. He would desire a good name over even if he could smell good all the time. And that good reputation, again, we're going to talk about the idea of a cost. It comes at a cost. It comes at a cost of consistency, of hard work, sometimes incredible labor. But hard workers rarely smell nice when the work is done. And he says that that is preferable. It is preferable to be known as a good worker or a hard worker, to be an individual who is trustworthy, even though that will at times cause disruption in your life. People being honorable, even though you have to make sacrifices sometimes to be honorable. He says that is much better when it comes to the concept of reputation. In Acts chapter 6 and verse 3, we see that being one of the conditions by which the apostles directed the people of the time to appoint deacons. That those individuals, 7 men, should be chosen from among you of good reputation, full of the Holy Spirit and wisdom, whom we may appoint over this business. They were going to put money in these people's hands effectively. They were going to give them authority over certain things. And so it was necessary that these individuals not only say that they are going to do this thing, but that the people have seen them do it already. That they have a good reputation for being a good steward of God's wealth. In 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 7, concerning elders, he says, moreover, he must have a good testimony among those who are outside. And then he gives you the reason. He says, lest he fall into reproach and the snare of the devil. I'll tell you, without a good reputation, you make the devil's job easier. You make his job a lot easier, because it is a lot easier to convict you of things if you have a bad reputation. If you are known for a certain thing, for doing some unspeakable thing or some awful thing, if you're known for cheating people, if you're known for bad communication, it will carry with you. It is hard to get rid of. And so you need to be one even before you become an elder or a deacon. Even if you can't become an elder or a deacon because of life situations, we need to be individuals who carry forward on our reputation, making sure that we keep it as clean as possible, that we make good choices, wise choices in the community, so that the people around us will respect us in relation to this reputation. Because a good name is better even than precious ointment. I would rather be known as a hard worker than a person who merely smelled nice and was lazy. Because there are two ways of smelling nice. One, by getting clean after you've done the hard work, and one by not getting dirty in the first place. And there's a lot of people who do the first, or who do the second, and who refuse to do the first. That hard work is important. And it requires protecting. A reputation is important not only to have to begin with, but one that is going to be built over a series of years. That if you develop a reputation, it's going to take you a good long time to develop it. But it can be lost in a moment. It can be lost in one poor choice. It can be lost with one bad decision. And so it is important to protect that reputation, not at all costs, obviously. Because a good reputation before God is even more preferable than a good reputation before men. But if you have to make the choice between smelling nice to man and physically and smelling nice to men as far as your reputation, you should pick the good reputation. It's always preferable. The second element he's going to bring in here is actually 6 of the 8 better than statements. See, I tricked you. You thought there were only 3 points to this sermon. In fact, there are 8, but I got you in the door, and now you're already stuck, so you can't leave. But these all get culminated in the concept of perspective. He's going to talk about a lot of concepts in regard to perspective, and he begins here in verse 1, the second half of verse 1. He says, the day of death, then the day of one's birth. This is what I was talking about earlier, where the word better than doesn't actually occur, but is supplied, because he already said, a good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death, and you would supply, is better than, though he doesn't need to, because he already said it. Then the day of one's birth, and that seems kind of odd. We cherish the youth. We look at the youth and we see this potential in them. And there's a romanticism about that, and that's fine, and that's nice. They do have this incredible potential. And sometimes you look at teenagers and you say, wow, they could really do a lot in this world. You see how they've grown and developed, and you see how far they could go, and you know that the sky is the limit. And then sometimes we look at older people and we say, well, their days are numbered. And yet Solomon, he says that the day of one's death is in fact better than the day of one's birth. And there's a few reasons why. And he's not talking about spiritually, though the Christian should immediately make that connection for themselves. He's not talking about that. Remember, he's talking about under the sun. He's not talking about a spirituality and a consistency in relation to heaven, though. Again, a Christian needs to keep that in mind. That helps that perspective that we want to have. What he is talking about is that the work is done. That the labor and the toil and the time that is needing to be spent on accomplishing a good reputation, on accomplishing all that needs to be done, is already accomplished, rather than it's already waiting for you, ahead of you. And there's a difference in perspective there, isn't it? That's an odd perspective, the way we talk about youth and how potential exists in front of them. But what also exists in front of them? Toil and hardships and pain and struggle and strife. And so he says, and he's already said this in chapter 4, in fact, that the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. He says in verse 2, better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. Again, this seems counterintuitive to us, but it comes down to perspective. If we spend all of our time, and he'll go on, if we spend all of our time in the house of feasting, then we won't know what life is really about, and we won't have the perspective that we need. There are some individuals who refuse to go to the house of mourning. Not that they don't need to, not that they don't need to be sorry for their actions, and they need to be sad over things that have happened in their life, but they just refuse to deal with things. But those hardships and those difficulties, they teach us things. And this is the cost, right? Just as the reputation, a good name has a cost. That you have had to make choices along the way that didn't allow you to indulge in this immediate gratification or instant gratification. You weren't able to do all of these things that other people might do, lie and steal and cheat, because you were trying to develop a good reputation, because you wanted to be trusted, and there is a reward in that. But there's also a cost. And the cost here is that we need to understand that life, yes, is difficult, that it's hard. And we learn from those hardships. I'll tell you, when I was a youth and I first was able to purchase my car, I drove an 84 Camaro, and that thing was, it was a beater car. That car was broken in all kinds of ways. And it needed fixed regularly. It leaked oil. It smelled awful. It just destroyed the gas tank. That is to say, the only thing I couldn't pass was a gas station. And that was true. But I love that car. You know why? Because I spent my time and energy. Because I bled in that car. I sweated in that car. And I bled in that car. And you could see the scars sometimes where that wrench let go of the nut and I cracked my knuckles. Anybody that's worked on a car knows what that's like. It is awful. Rake your knuckles across one of the bolts or one of the arms that are everywhere. And I appreciated that car. And you know, I didn't race that car. I could have. We dropped a larger engine in it. My dad taught me how to drive fast. But I spent my hard-earned money on that car. And I spent my blood and my sweat in that car. I wasn't getting that car taken away, and I wasn't going to wreck it. But my friends, especially my friends whose parents bought them the car, they didn't always appreciate what they had been given. They didn't appreciate how the hard work that was involved in it. They didn't work on their car. They didn't spend time taking care of their car. But I did mine. And that's not to say a person can't appreciate what is given to them, but it's not necessarily going to happen as easily. He says, "For that is the end of all men, and the living will take it to heart. The house of mourning and the house of feasting, both are acceptable places to go." He's not saying you should never go to the house of feasting. He's saying you learn a lot more in the house of mourning than you do in the house of feasting. You gain perspective from the house of mourning. You don't gain any perspective from the house of feasting. Now, it's fine going there from time to time, but you should not dwell there. You should not stay there. You should not live there. There is a life to be lived, and there are things to be done, and feasting's not going to get any of them done. He says, "For that is the end of all men, mourning." And especially the house of mourning in their culture would have been from death. The end of all men is physical death. The body deteriorates, or accidents happen, and a person dies. And it is the living that take it to heart. Funerals are for the living, not the dead. And that's something I struggle getting people to understand, especially people that aren't part of the body of Christ. And that makes sense, I suppose, because to them life is the end of, or life is it. That's all there is. And so they sometimes mourn over those that are passing, and rightfully so, but they don't really gain anything from the funeral because they want their relative preached into heaven, or they want to celebrate them. They want to pay their respects to the person. Well, you should be paying your respects to the family that's left behind. You should be taking care of them. It's not about the person in the casket. It's about the people that remain. And this is the end of all men. And that's something that we need to keep in mind. That when there's someone lying in the casket and we're there to mourn with the family, or we're there mourning ourselves, we need to remember that there's coming a day where we're going to be the one in the casket. And what kind of life are we leading here on earth? And what kind of example are we setting? He says in verse 3, "Sorrow is better than laughter." Now, no single person who would say, "Yes, I have an opportunity to be sad or sorrowful rather than to laugh." And yet, James chapter 1, verses 2 and 3 says, "My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience." Again, he's coming right back to perspective. That you can gain more perspective. You can gain more as an individual from a hardship than you can from an easy situation. He says, notice this at the end of verse 3, "For by a sad countenance, the heart is made better." He even tells you exactly why. And so he culminates this passage, these three better than, all in the sense that sorrow is better than laughter, for by a sad countenance, the heart is made better. That we have opportunity to improve. But you don't improve from laughter, right? Maybe your humor improves. Maybe you've got a new keen joke that you can tell people and probably mess up if it's me and probably laugh so hard that you can't actually tell the joke. But that doesn't help you any. Whereas if we learn to appreciate our human growth, the ability to grow as a human being and to move forward with our life, then these obstacles, these hardships, these difficulties can be seen as opportunities rather than merely those hardships and difficulties and things to be avoided. And so some people do. The heart, he says, of the wise is in the house of mourning. but the heart of the fool is in the house of mirth. Fools show their commitment. They don't know well enough to mourn. They only know how to party. And they won't mourn when it's appropriate. Now, a wise man will spend some time in the house of mirth, will have enjoyment in his life. He doesn't have to be a dour, awful human being, someone who doesn't know how to laugh. But he also understands when to mourn, when to be sad, when to be sorrowful, especially, and let's draw back out of Ecclesiastes again, especially when it comes to sin. There are many people who laugh at sin, who think sin is a joke. And you don't have to go far in this world. Doesn't take long before you turn the TV on and you find out exactly how this world views sin. And yet, we Christians too often get caught up in that, and we will laugh at inappropriate jokes. We will find ourselves enjoying shows that we ought not, when in fact we should mourn. Mourn the sin that goes on in this world and the life that people choose to lead, rather than join them in partying and enjoying this life in all of those awful ways. If we move down to verse 8, we'll get to 5 through 7 in a moment. If we move down to verse 8, he says, "The end of the thing is better than its beginning." Now, he just drew what he said at the beginning, didn't he? Verse 1, "And the day of death is better than the day of one's birth." And so he's moved to the next degree. "The end of a thing is better than its beginning." Now, this I get. I mean, how often have you had to run a race and you've been really glad at the start line and really sad at the finish line? I'm happy at the finish line, usually because I managed to finish. But in anything, right, the reveal is what's enjoyable. You finish a project, you build a bookshelf, or you take care of the house and you're cleaning up. The beginning of a project is hard. It's excruciating sometimes because it's so overwhelming or it seems so overwhelming. And yet when you finish it, you have this sense, this feeling of accomplishment. That's what he's talking about this whole time. And we have to draw to, I don't know if you do, but I draw to cleaning the house or doing a project. Something that is very temporal, something that's very small in my spectrum of life. It matters and it makes sense to me. Now let's draw it back to the day of one's death. Can we appreciate the life that we've lived? It's said that an individual who leads a good and righteous life can remember with fondness at the end of it all the things that he's done. And that's not going to be the case for a lot of people. There are going to be things that they are ashamed of. There are going to be things, many, many things. Now, you're going to have some things that you're probably ashamed of or choices you wish you'd done better. But if you commit yourself to God and to his kingdom, not only do you have something to look forward to after your days are over, but you can look forward to the time when you can look back at your life and you can say, "I did my best. I put forth full effort to be his. The end of a thing is better than its beginning." He says, "The patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit." Once again, he's in perspective. That it's more important to be patient. Because the boastful and the proud, the arrogant, they run forward. And they cry out with their accomplishments. But the one who is patient knows that the end of a thing sometimes doesn't happen when you think. There were many individuals. Jesus tells of a story of servants who, even though their master had warned them that he would return, they take the opportunity to beat their fellow servants. They take the opportunity to take advantage of the situation. But a few are faithful. A few remain faithful to the Lord, the house. And when the Lord returns at a time they are not expecting, some are rewarded and some are punished. Those who refuse to be patient in spirit. Excuse me. In verse 9 he says, "Do not hasten in your spirit to be angry, for anger rests in the bosom of fools." I really like that. I really like that, in part because it described me when I was young. I used to be very angry young man. I used to have a big problem with my aggression, with my anger. And it took a long time to grow and mature so that I could understand how to live my life and to do what God has called me to do. It really reminds me of James chapter 1, verses 19 and 20, when he says, "So then, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath." Yeah, that wasn't me a lot younger. I still struggle with that, slow to speak. I've been told I could slow down on how quickly I talk. But he's not talking about that in particular. He's talking about how you shoot off at the mouth. And I had a real problem with that. And the anger, the wrath. He says there in verse 20, "For the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God." Now there is a righteous indignation, one we see like in Jesus' situation in John chapter 2, when those money changers have been taking advantage of the temple and they had turned his father's house into a den of thieves, and he runs them out. He is angry about the situation, but he is not angry in a selfish way. He is angry that they have taken advantage not only of the area that was dedicated to the Gentiles, but more importantly, that they have besmirched his father's house with this ungodliness. Now, if we could learn to be angry when it's right to be angry and not to be angry when it's not right to be angry, we would be in a good spot. We would be well on our way to righteousness. But anger, he says, rests in the bosom of fools. I was taught a long time ago, my mother spent a long time trying to teach me, that if someone can make you angry, they control you. If they can cause you to do something that you wouldn't normally do, and something more particularly that'll get you in trouble, then they control you. Because it's not the first person, you probably learned this in any sport, it's not the first person that acts, but the person that reacts that gets caught. And even though, and you can point your finger at the other person and tell them all the nasty things they said about you or all the nasty things they did to you, but if you're the one that gets caught doing it, you're the one that gets in trouble. And so controlling your aggression, controlling your anger, controlling that wrath, and knowing that your wrath does not produce the righteousness of God, regardless of where it comes from. He says in verse 10, "Do not say, why were the former days better than these?" So technically there's a nine better than statements, but I don't really count this one because he's not talking about it. This is the word of a fool who says, times in the past have been better than now. And that's an easy thing to do. We call it the prisoner of the moment. That the life that you live, and it's always that way. If you talk to people about who's the best basketball player, and they tout LeBron James. And usually that's because they're prisoners of the moment. They didn't see Michael Jordan play. Because that's the right answer. Yeah, I know. I'm in Ohio. But my point is that when you are in the moment and you're watching someone in that moment, you're more likely to consider them the best or the worst than you are to really have a good understanding of the spectrum and to be able to place people effectively in any kind of setting like that. And he says that you don't be prisoners of the moment. He says, don't say, why were former days better than these? Well, what makes them any different? He says, for you do not inquire wisely concerning this. There's no point in it, for one, because you live in the world you live in. Wishing that things were different doesn't change anything. Wondering why things have changed, that's at least useful, because then you can figure out what needs to change in order to make it better. But wondering or just complaining about life and how it's not as good as it used to be, there's no benefit in that. There's no advantage. And assuming that it's better in the past than it is in the present or it will be in the future also isn't helpful. What we need to do will be people who are forward thinking and find ways of making them better. So this is one of those better thans that you shouldn't say, in fact. But his point here seems to be how it's hard to appreciate light without darkness. And the point that he's made numerous times already, it's hard to appreciate rest when you haven't worked. But the rest of a man who has labored, that is something that is sweet. And that takes perspective. That you can appreciate a hard day's work. That you can appreciate the time and commitment it takes. That you can appreciate even the things that have gone wrong in your life because they brought you to the place where you are and they've helped you to grow. And it's not always in the moment that you realize these things, but sometimes well down the road when you realize that you have changed. And it's not because of those days of feasting or the mirth or the laughter, but it's because of the hardships that you have gone through and you have overcome, and drawing back from Ecclesiastes again, that the Lord has gotten you through. Those are the things that help us to grow. Those are the things that give us perspective. And perspective is always better than not having perspective. But perspective comes at a cost. It comes at a cost of loss, of damage, of going through awful things sometimes. And then he, we'd say concludes, but I'm going to begin here in verse 5, in fact. You've got three elements running through here, and all of them have to do with wisdom, obviously. In verse 5, he says, "It is better to hear the rebuke of the wise, than for a man to hear the song of fools." And it seems implied that the song of fools is praise to you. There have been times where my friends, especially in high school, they're lauding me and they're talking highly of me. I should have known that what they were encouraging me to do and what they were commending me on was exactly the opposite of what I should have been doing. I should have realized that I was listening to the song of fools, that I was listening to my own press clippings, that I was happy about some idiocy that I was involved in because my friends, who were really dumb sometimes, were on board. And that should have been my first clue. The fact that they like this decision, that they like this idea, that they're on board with this, should have been my first clue. And my second should have been the wisdom that my parents taught me and the rules that they gave me, because they had expressed wisdom in the rules that they gave me, in the wisdom that they had tried to pass on, sometimes futilely. It's better to hear the rebuke of the wise, but the rebuke is not appreciated. You don't like when people rebuke you, but the wise, when they rebuke you, not only hopefully are they going to be as gentle as they can be, it's still not pleasant. It's still not nice when someone comes to you and they say, "What you just did, that was dumb." Or, "What you just did was sinful. What you just did, you shouldn't have done." And who here likes hearing that? Who here is going to go, "Hey, thanks. Yeah, I should have really done that differently." But when people have your back and when the songs of fools are playing through your ears, it is difficult to make a good decision. Notice in verse 6, he compares the song of fools to a crackling of thorns under a pot. That was a hard one to get. I know what he's talking about, but I don't put pots in the grass, so I don't know what thorns scratching on them. The closest I could relate would be when you're a kid and there's a tree outside your window, and when it is windy, especially at night, how creepy it is and how that branch can scratch against the window. But you think about nails on a chalkboard, how irritating those are, how scary that tree is outside your window. You're convinced it's a monster. So you call for your parents. He says, the song of fools is like the crackling of thorns under a pot. How irritating it is, that scratching. And he says, so is the laughter of the fool. This also is vanity, the laughter of that fool. That the song of the fools, we shouldn't listen to that. And we got people trying to encourage us, and we know who they are. We know what kind of choices they make. Perhaps we need to reevaluate the choices that we're making if we receive the song of fools. In verse 7, he says, surely oppression destroys a wise man's reason, and a bribe debases the heart. Wickedness is everywhere, he says. Now, it shouldn't surprise you when wickedness peers its ugly head, and even when you make good decisions, and even when you are wise, sometimes the evil man wins, and that can be daunting, and that can really, here he says, debase the wise man. It can really destroy the wise man's confidence in that wisdom, because sometimes the evil man wins. Sometimes things work out for the evil man in a way that it does not work out for the righteous man, and that's okay. If you go down to verse 11, he says, wisdom is good with an inheritance and profitable to those who see the sun. Now, the prodigal son did not read Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 11. He should have been wise with his inheritance. He wasn't asking for anything that was untoward. In fact, that was a very common thing for the second son to ask, so that he could make a life for himself, because all that was his father's was going to be passed down to the first son, and he would receive a portion monetarily. Now, he could stay under the thumb of the older brother, but oftentimes children didn't. The younger child wanted to go out on their own, wanted to make a life for themselves, and so they would ask like this prodigal son does. Now, it's when he goes out and he is wasteful with what he has, when he doesn't make wise choices, he ends up in the situation he is, that he is lost and foolish. He says, for wisdom, I love verse 12. For wisdom is a defense as money is a defense. You know, some people, the only thing that keeps them out of jail is how much money and how many connections they have. And he says, even though that's the case, wisdom is also a defense. He doesn't say it's a better defense, because there's not a lot that stands in the way of corruption, of human corruption. But wisdom is also a defense. Your good reputation will help you, right? Being wise and making sure you make good decisions along the way and you build that good reputation, you make wise choices, you gain that perspective along the way, you will make even better choices. And along the way, you will grow and develop and you will have that good reputation that will be a defense for you, among other things. He says, notice the second half, but the excellence of knowledge is that wisdom gives life to those who have it. What's the difference? Now again, he's not getting into the spiritual that we easily could. He says, wisdom gives life to those who have it, wisdom. Money doesn't. Money brings a hardship. Money brings problems. And though many people think that money solves their problems, all it does is cause more. And Paul would talk about that. We've already talked about it numerous times in 1 Timothy chapter 6, of how it brings on hardships and destruction ultimately. And the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. A wisdom that supersedes the wisdom of this world, the presumed wisdom of this world, brings one life. Now, there is no wiser choice, obviously, drawing again back out of Ecclesiastes and those things that are under the sun, there's no wiser choice than becoming a child of God. In Matthew chapter 7 and verse 13 and 14, he says, enter by the narrow gate, for wide is the gate, and broad is the way that leads to destruction. And there are many who go in by it, because narrow is the gate and difficult is the way which leads to life, and there are few who find it. The easy path is rarely the right path. The shortcuts that you're going to take in your Christianity and in your life are going to catch up with you. And when you try to do that which is wrong and succeed, you've really failed. You've really failed at life, and you failed most particularly in your relationship with God. If you want true wisdom, you should listen to the last of the words of the book of Ecclesiastes, that the whole of man is to do the will of God, is to commit to that will and to follow it all the days of your life, is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might, and to love your neighbor as yourself. You need to make the wise choice tonight. If you haven't made that wise choice of becoming a Christian, if you haven't made that wise choice of returning to Him, your life is in jeopardy. Your future and eternity is in jeopardy. And if we can help you because you're struggling with sin and difficulties, because the dangers and the depth of sin in this world can be overwhelming, it can seem overwhelming. It's not overwhelming. I should say that. It's never so much that we can't overcome, but it can seem that to the degree that we let in, that we give up. But we can never give up. We must always press forward, because wisdom demands and supports fairness, even when it would be easier to take the sinful path. Don't take that path. Know that the right path is usually the difficult path, but it's also the worthwhile path. And if we can help you tonight to make your life right with God, I pray that you would let it be known as together we stand and sing.